Now, before we dive into today's episode, if you're a dog owner like me, you know that keeping our four-legged family members healthy is a top priority. That's why I want to tell you about Butternut Box. They make fresh, gently cooked meals using whole human-quality ingredients, cooked at 90 degrees Celsius and then frozen to lock in all the good stuff. There's absolutely no added preservatives or nasties. When your dog switches to real, fresh food, the difference is night and day. You'll see better digestion, an improved appetite, and a shinier coat. The meals are perfectly portioned and delivered frozen straight to your door, or you can even pick them up in Maxi Zoo stores. To give it a go, visit butternutbox.com/lines of inquiry and use the code Lines of Inquiry for 50% off your first two boxes. Fresh food, happy dogs.
It's September 26th, 2006. Brothers Robert and Niall Howard are at home in the house they share with friends on the outskirts of Ennis, County Clare. It's been a long day for the brothers, who started their day with the discovery that two computers had been burgled from the office of their family business. At 10:30 p.m, Robert's mobile phone rings. On the other end is a man with an accent Robert can't identify. He's saying he'd heard Robert was looking for some computers. Thinking this is a tip-off of some sort, Robert agrees. The anonymous man tells him, "I'll be at your house in 5 minutes." Robert doubts the caller is telling the truth. He never even asked for his address. Robert tells his brother Niall about the call. A few minutes later, a knock at the door startles them. While Niall waits out of sight, Robert opens the door. A man is standing on the front step in a white tracksuit jacket. He wears a navy baseball cap emblazoned with US Open 2000. He's in his late 40s or early 50s. He's 6 feet tall, maybe a little shorter. He has sallow skin and wears glasses. There's a car in the driveway, with a woman in the passenger seat. The man in the hat introduces himself as Tony Luciano and hands over one of the laptops stolen earlier that day. Robert takes it inside and tells Niall to call the Gardaí. Back at the front door, the man says something that makes this about much more than a stolen computer. Something that would start a bizarre, barely believable journey. The man says he has been hired to kill Robert, Niall, and their father, PJ. He has been promised €130,000 to kill all three, he says. But if they can pay him €100,000, he'll spare their lives. When someone is killed in Ireland, the Gardaí call in a specialist unit of forensic crime scene examiners from the Technical Bureau. This is Ireland's real-life version of CSI, but it's nothing like the movies or TV shows. For 25 years, I was one of the detectives on that team. My name is John Sweetman. My job as a Garda detective in the Technical Bureau was to read the evidence that could not speak for itself. I learned to see what others might miss. Fingerprints smudged on a handle of a door. Weapons disguised in everyday objects. Handwritten notes that revealed more than the writer ever intended. The smallest traces often unraveled the big story. And now, I'm here to tell you those stories. In this podcast from Go Loud, I take you inside some of Ireland's most haunting investigations. This is Lines of Inquiry, a Go Loud original podcast that follows the evidence step by step and tries to uncover the real story behind the headlines. This week, we revisit a case that proves that sometimes the truth really is stranger than fiction. Deception and double-crossing, an international hitman, a blonde bombshell, and the FBI. In a murderous plot so wild, it belongs in a Hollywood movie. On the morning of Monday, September 26, 2006, Gardaí in Ennis, County Clare, received a relatively routine call. A local business had been burgled overnight. The open space car park that stretched across the Westgate Business Park was mostly empty when Gardaí arrived at the Downs and Howard property office. They expected it to be a simple break-in, likely motivated by the quick resale value of office electronics. Officers arrived to meet Robert and Niall Howard, the two brothers in their 20s who managed the business. Their father, PJ Howard, was the owner, but he wound back his involvement due to recurring health problems and to enjoy the better things in life. The Howard family were well known and respected in Ennis. They managed commercial rentals and larger scale developments, which had made them one of the wealthiest families in the Midwest area, controlling a 60 million euro property empire. PJ Howard owned homes in Ireland and Spain and had a boat called Heartbeat, named in honour of his quadruple heart bypass. PJ shared his sprawling lakeside home named Ballybeg House, 10 kilometres outside Ennis, with his partner, Sharon Collins, who he'd been with for 8 years. Robert and Niall were his sons from a previous marriage, and Sharon also had two grown-up sons from a prior relationship. Robert and Niall had come to work that morning to find a laptop, a desktop computer, and the cables gone. At first it seemed that was all that was missing, but they soon realised other items had disappeared too. A silver-framed digital clock and a framed picture of 7 old Irish banknotes. Why anyone would take those baffled the brothers and Gardaí. In 2006, Gardaí responded to about 25,000 burglaries across Ireland. Of those, only 6% were in County Clare. Apart from minor urban offences in Ennis and Shannon, the county's rural stretches and coastal villages remain close to untouched by serious violent crime. Centred on the banks of the River Fergus, the town is packed with colourful shopfronts, traditional pubs, and intact medieval streetscapes, like the 13th century Ennis Friary. None of the shops or offices surrounding Downs and Howard property had been broken into. Gardaí on the scene noted that there was no sign of forced entry, no smashed windows or jimmied locks. The brothers had both worked in the office the day before and were sure that they'd locked up as usual. But when they opened up that morning, they found only one of the two chub locks on the door was locked. When Robert went upstairs, he found the alarm wasn't on. He knew he'd put it on when he left the previous night. It appeared someone had entered the office with both the keys and the code to the alarm. Few people had this level of access to the premises. Just the brothers, their father and his partner, a handyman and the cleaner. The following morning, Tuesday, September 27th, Robert met with Superintendent John Scanlon at Ennis Garda Station. He described a strange visit to their home the previous evening. He told about the man with a strange accent who arrived at their front door, just minutes after calling on the phone, to say he knew Robert was looking for some computers. Within minutes, the man was at his and Niall's front door, saying he'd been hired to kill the brothers and their father, PJ. He had introduced himself as Tony Luciano. Robert told Superintendent Scanlon that Tony had handed over the missing laptop and then showed him some documents. There were maps to his and his father's homes and photos of PJ and his partner Sharon, even a photo of PJ on his boat in Spain. Robert then explained this man, claiming his name was Tony Luciano, had told him he had been offered 130,000 euros to murder him, his brother and their father, and he had offered to spare their lives for 90,000 euro. When Robert had gone inside briefly to speak to his brother Niall about calling Gardaí, Tony Luciano took the chance to speed away. Robert got into his Jeep and tried to follow their car, but as they approached the unlit crossroads, Tony switched his headlights off and Robert lost him entirely. The brothers had decided to wait until the morning to go to the Gardaí. The idea that someone was hired to kill them and their father seemed outrageous. Knowing the Howards were worth tens of millions of euros, Superintendent Scanlon realised the burglary was not as simple as they had initially assumed and took the extortion threat seriously. For Gardaí, The idea that a mysterious man was trying to extort the Howard family for money seemed possible. But the idea that he'd been hired to kill them? That felt less plausible. For a start, they could think of no possible suspects or motive. Superintendent Scanlon suggested Robert should continue speaking to Tony Luciano if he called again. Meanwhile, he would put a team together to track them through a wiretap on Robert's phone. Just after midday, Luciano called again. He wanted to know whether Robert was getting the money and what time he would be finishing work. Robert just told him the usual time. At 4:45 p.m., Tony called again. This time he wanted to meet at the bus station to exchange the money for the missing computer. Robert refused, but agreed to meet at 5:15 p.m. in the Queen's Hotel in central Ennis, just yards from Ennis Garda Station. Gardaí planned a sting operation. By 5 p.m, 8 Gardaí were positioned in a 360-degree radius around the hotel, a four-story Georgian building. Outside, detectives hid in the car park of the neighbouring 13th-century Franciscan friary. Inside the hotel, two more plain-clothed Gardaí sat at the bar near Robert. Robert waited for the next call. 5:15 came and went, and Robert waited. Then his phone rang. Gardaí at the bar watched him take several calls. They grew nervous. Then a woman walked in, 40s, dark curly hair and wearing a leather jacket. She continued through the pub towards the toilets. Outside, detectives noticed a suspicious man in a beige anorak and glasses, fitting the description Robert had given of Tony Luciano. They watched as the man went to use a public phone. At the bar, Robert received a call. It was Tony. "Go to the toilets and meet a woman there so she can count the money." Robert got up from his seat and went around to the hallway outside the toilets. There he came face to face with the woman in the leather jacket. "Have you got the envelope?" she said. "Well, have you got the computer?" Robert replied. The plainclothes Gardaí waited 10 seconds before leaving the bar and following Robert. The woman in the leather jacket ran from the pub. Outside, detectives saw the woman in the leather jacket trying to escape. She approached the man who had just left the phone box and was by then standing opposite the pub. The couple separated again and the woman went in one direction as the detectives approached the man they suspected was Tony Luciano to arrest him. The man said his name was Essam Eid and he was on holiday in Ireland. He said his name was not Tony Luciano. The woman in the leather jacket walked to a hire car the pair had parked earlier. When she arrived at the car, Gardaí were waiting to arrest her. She said her name was Teresa Engel. The two were taken to Ennis Garda Station. Neither had mobile phones. Gardaí believed that they didn't have them at the Queen's Hotel either, which meant they'd had to rely on both lines of sight and the payphone to communicate. The earlier phone calls to Robert were made from a well-known hotel about half an hour away, the Two Mile Inn. Detectives travelled the 30 kilometres down the N18 to the pyramid-shaped Two Mile Inn at Meelik, sure that that was where the man and the woman had been staying. The inn's receptionist confirmed that on Saturday, 3 days earlier, she had checked in an international couple into room 208. The man had checked in as Tony Luciano, but didn't use a credit card, as the room had been fully paid in advance for 7 nights. Since check-in, Tony Luciano had called reception several times to ask if there were any messages for him. Gardaí were given printed-out copies of all the calls made from the room since the couple had checked in. The officers, armed with a warrant, had staff open the door of room 208. In the room were two large suitcases and a plastic bag. Inside were computer leads and two keys. There was a white tracksuit top and a navy blue baseball cap with a US Open 2000 logo on it. There was another computer cable, this time for a desktop computer. there was a digital clock and a poster of old Irish currency. Under the bed, they found gloves, a balaclava and a Halloween mask, plus two wigs, one blonde and one black. But there were no guns or weapons to suggest this man, whether he was Tony Luciano or Sam Ead, was about to carry out a hit on the Howard brothers. The laptop cable found fit the stolen laptop. The keys fit the burgled office. The second stolen computer wasn't there. At Enniscarta station, detectives asked Sam Ead why he had told Robert Howard and staff at the hotel that his name was Tony Luciano. "Why would I ever call myself Tony?" Ead said. "I always introduce myself as Sam or Esam. Why would I use Tony?" He said he had no idea how many of the items from the Howard's office came to be in his hotel room. He claimed he had never seen any of the items before, and he knew nothing of another missing computer. He said someone must have entered his room through an open window and put the things in his luggage. He insisted he had no knowledge of the burglary or the Howard family. He said he had been nowhere near Robert and Niall's home the night before. Asked what he was doing in Ireland, Ead explained that he and his wife, Teresa, were visiting Ennis on a holiday from their home in Las Vegas. She had visited Ennis before and loved it. They'd flown from Las Vegas and planned to return to the US after 7 days. 51-year-old Sam Ead was Egyptian-born, but had lived in the United States for 30 years. Everything he said about his background checked out. When questioned why a different American woman had called the Two Mile Inn saying she was his wife, Ead said, "Well, she is." He explained to Gardaí they were both his wives. Around a year earlier, Ead had married Teresa Engel. They met while both worked in a casino in Detroit. When they met, Ead lived with his first wife, Lisa. At the time, Teresa was separated from her husband, who she had married three separate times. When Ead later left Detroit to move to Las Vegas with Lisa and their teenage daughter, Teresa followed. Ead and Teresa then married in Vegas, while Ead was still married to Lisa. With no centralized database across the states of the US, there was no system to flag that Ead was already married. Teresa then moved in with Ead, Lisa, and their daughter. Detectives then continued through the list of phone records from the hotel. Another name had caught their eye, a local woman, Sharon Collins, the partner of PJ Howard for 8 years, the same PJ Howard who Tony Luciano, or Ead, had claimed he was hired to kill. Sharon had called the hotel to speak to Ead several times. Detective Jarlath Fahy pushed a photo of Sharon Collins across the table and asked Ead again if he knew PJ Howard. Ead admitted that he had heard of PJ Howard, but only because he and Sharon Collins had been lovers. He said they'd been seeing each other secretly for 2 or 3 years. He told Gardaí he had visited her a month earlier on PJ's boat in Malaga, while PJ was back in Ennis. He said he often spoke with her on the phone from the US, and this trip was supposed to be him visiting her again in Malaga, but his wife, Teresa, had insisted on coming to Ireland too. "Who really paid for your flights?" Detective Garda Fahy asked. "Sharon," Ead replied. According to Ead, Sharon had paid for Teresa's flight and hotel as well, believing she was a friend and co-worker of Ead's. He said he hadn't told Sharon that Teresa was his wife. He denied ever meeting Robert or Niall, but said it was possible that PJ knew of his affair with Sharon. Gardaí believed Ead's new story. Perhaps the bizarre jumble of events was beginning to make sense. They thought it was possible that when Ead arrived in Ireland, he had realised the extent of his lover's wealth and had made up the kill-for-hire story to get Sharon's partner to hand over some money. That night, Sergeant Noel McMahon carried out an identity parade in the hope that the Howard brothers might identify the man who had appeared at their door. As the line of men stood before them, the brothers had no doubt that the man with the sallow complexion, glasses and very large moustache, was the man who had called to their home. Essam Eid was charged with burglary and demanding €100,000 to cancel the murder contracts on the lives of PJ Howard and his two sons. Without any evidence tying Teresa Engel directly to the extortion demands, she was released and allowed to return to America, leaving Eid behind. When the burglary and extortion attempt happened, PJ and Sharon were holidaying at their penthouse apartment in Spain, but returned home when they heard of the events in County Clare. PJ and Sharon had met 8 years earlier, in 1998, when he was 49 and she was 35. PJ's partner of 6 years had passed away, and prior to that, he'd separated from his wife of 19 years, who was mother to Robert and Niall. Sharon, divorced with two teenage sons, worked in a furniture shop leased from PJ and his property business. When PJ came into the shop on the day they met, Sharon knew who he was. Sharon described their meeting as fate. PJ walked in and asked Sharon to dinner. And he didn't mean dinner in Ennis either. He meant dinner in Spain. Within a month, Sharon and her sons had moved into PJ's lakeside home. A couple of years later, PJ underwent a quadruple heart bypass operation, and soon the pair holidayed more, and PJ worked less. In Malaga, he bought the boat he named Heartbeat. He was wealthy when they met, but as the years progressed, so did his wealth. And by 2006, when Essam Eid entered their lives, PJ's property empire was worth close to €60 million. He owned multiple homes in the west of Ireland, including a holiday home near Ennis, a beach house in Kilkee, and his two-story penthouse in Malaga. Sharon had grown up with her parents and two sisters on an estate in County Clare. In her late teens, her parents separated, and when she finished school, she went on to study a computer course. She married at 19 and had two sons. They lived in Ennis, before she and her husband divorced when she was 27. She'd been granted the deserted wives' allowance and unemployment benefit for a while, before eventually renting the shop to sell furniture. It was there that she met PJ. Sharon became a part-time clerical assistant at Downs and Howard, where she was paid well and received a monthly stipend of €1,000 from PJ. Her job was flexible, so she often joined PJ on his lengthy trips to Spain. Following PJ's bypass, she bought a franchise for a stretch-and-grow enterprise for €18,000, a children's health and fitness franchise. In 2003, Robert and Niall's mother died suddenly of a brain hemorrhage. It had been 10 years since she and PJ had separated, but they had made the choice not to divorce. Her passing meant that PJ was free to marry Sharon, and he proposed the following January. As they planned the wedding, PJ spoke with his sons and his solicitor about inheritance of his estate. His sons had worked for Downs and Howard and had already begun taking over the business. They had helped PJ through his health battles, and he was adamant that Robert and Niall would inherit the company. As prenuptial agreements are not valid under Irish law, PJ was stuck between wanting to provide for Sharon and her sons, but also protecting the business he felt his sons should solely inherit. So, although Sharon wanted to get married, she accepted the legal conundrum, and over a number of months of discussions, she was happy with the decision they'd come to. PJ and Sharon would not marry after all. PJ supported Sharon wanting to save face after having been so thrilled when he proposed. She had already sent out invitations. They kept the new situation private and still planned to celebrate. In 2005, they had a ceremony in Sorrento, Italy, and when they returned to Ennis, they threw a party for family and friends. On that day, many of the guests believed the couple had married. Back in Ennis, Gardaí were attempting to unravel the complex mystery of Essam Eid and the story of a hitman targeting the Howard family. They returned to the 2 Mile Inn to check for further evidence of extortion. They discovered that shortly after Eid was arrested, A worker at the hotel had found an old desktop computer in bushes behind the building. It was a bit dirty and wet, so she brought it inside and cleaned it up, then eventually put it in a storeroom. Looking at it, Gardaí realized it was the missing desktop computer, taken from the Howard's offices. A separate examination on the office laptop showed that on the evening of September the 26th, just hours before Ede arrived on Robert's doorstep, someone had used the laptop to check American baseball results. The user then accessed the contents of a profile labeled Robert and checked some email accounts. One of these was registered to Tony Luciano at hirehitman@yahoo.com. From that address, an email was sent to lyingeyes98@yahoo.ie. It read, "Call me as soon as possible. I'm not going to wait here for nothing. I have to leave here by Sunday morning." Gardaí contacted authorities in the United States and informed them they had Essam Eid in custody and Teresa Engel had been released without charge. Gardaí had hoped that they could work with the FBI to get the evidence they needed to prove Essam Eid had targeted the Howard family for their money. They found that an FBI agent in Los Angeles, Ingrid Sotelo, had already been in contact with the FBI's attaché in London. She had been tracking Ede's tail in relation to a case she was investigating, but had lost all trace of him when he flew to Ireland. Soon, investigators on both sides of the Atlantic realized they were searching for information on the same man. Gardaí learned that Essam Ede had attempted an almost identical extortion plan on a woman in Southern California. But what the FBI revealed put a drastic new dimension on the case for Gardaí. They informed them that the murder plot wasn't a hoax. It was very real. The FBI believed Ede had legitimately been hired to kill a woman. But instead of murdering her, he tried to make her pay to save her own life. Gardaí realized that the murder-for-hire plot they had believed was a lie and a story that couldn't be explained was, in fact, very real.
We all want our dogs to live the happiest, healthiest lives possible. But a lot of standard dog food out there just isn't cutting it. That's where Butternut Box comes in. Their mission is simple: to deliver health and happiness to dogs and their humans. They use high-quality, whole ingredients that are so good they've actually been taste-tested by humans. When your dog starts eating better food, you see the results directly. More excitement at mealtimes, a shinier coat, and a much happier gut. It's not about being fancy, it's just about giving them real food that brings out the best in them. If you want to make the switch, head over to butternutbox.com/lines of inquiry. Use the promo code Lines of Inquiry at the checkout and they'll give you a massive 50% off your first two boxes. Your dog will thank you for it.
On December 4th, 2007, 2 months after the arrest in Ireland, the FBI raided Ede's home in Las Vegas. Agents found a 9mm pistol with a homemade rubber silencer. Beside the family computer, a folder of email printouts was found. In it, an email to Tony Luciano dated 8th of August, 6 weeks before Ede's arrest. It was an automatic email, with information someone had filled out on a contact form on the Hire a Hitman website. It read, "From S. Cronin. Phone number supplied. Contact time, within the next 15 hours. Comments. 2 male marks in Ireland. ASAP. Usually together. MU like accident. Then possibly a third within 24 hours. Prefera like suicide. Would appreciate a call by return." In Ede's address book, agents found a phone number written down that matched the number left by this person, the S. Cronin. They took away paperwork, notebooks, and the computer to search its hard drive. On the computer, they found more evidence related to Tony Luciano and the Hire a Hitman website. Agents began to suspect Ede was running the website himself. Looking at the landing page of hireahitman.com, they saw a comic-style image of a mobster in a trench coat a trilby hat, and holding a Tommy gun. The text read, "Assassinations are the most practical solutions to common problems. Thanks to the internet, ordering a hit has never been easier. We manage a network of freelance assassins, available to kill at a moment's notice." At first, the agents thought it must have been a joke, but as they trawled his Google history, they could see it was something far more. Shortly after launching the website, Eid had immediately Googled information about being a hitman. He had also searched how to make a weapon and a silencer from toilet parts. And it went on. They discovered a saved recipe for the almost undetectable poison, ricin, a tasteless and odorless powder made from castor beans. It is a poison that could be sprinkled into a drink or on food, and one that would take 3 or 4 days to take effect, allowing the killer to be near undetectable. In Eid's backyard, agents found the shriveled dead castor bean plant. Yahoo provided the FBI with access to hire a hitman's emails. They found messages between Tony Luciano and people across the world inquiring about arranging murders. A fifth grade girl from Kentucky wanted another girl in her class dead. Women, one in Pennsylvania and another in Ireland, had queries about men in their lives being killed. Some of the inquiries were from others applying to be killers themselves. There were also a series of emails linking Eid to Agent Sotelo's Los Angeles case. But by far the longest and most frequent emails were between Tony and one particular person, using the email address lyingeyes98@yahoo.ie. It was an email address familiar to the Garda Cybercrime Unit. The desktop computer, which had been dumped near the 2 Mile Inn, proved to be the device that the lyingeyes98 email address had been set up from the month before the burglary. That same day, someone used the computer to look up flights to Malaga, from either Dublin or Shannon. They also searched for domestic violence, parent equality, women's aid, and inheritance rights for cohabiting couples. Another search revealed someone logged onto the office computer to check a FedEx tracking number for a package bound for Las Vegas. Then, an email was sent from lyingeyes98 to Tony Luciano. In it, the sender told him €15,000 in cash had been sent, wrapped in brown paper and cardboard, along with a pair of gaming goggles, to Tony's address. And then, an email address in Sharon Collins' name was found on that computer, being used at exactly the same time as the lyingeyes98 email was accessed. Gardaí then discovered Sharon's mother's maiden name was Cronin, the exact name the email found in Vegas was signed off as, S. Cronin. As for 98, that was the year Sharon and PJ met. Gardaí pulled Sharon Collins' phone records and cross-referenced them with SM Eid's hotel phone calls and his mobile phone data. The information they gathered told the story. Roughly 70 calls had been made between phones used by Eid and Sharon throughout August and September of 2006. On August 20th and 23rd alone, a phone registered to Eid received 21 calls from Sharon Collins' Spanish mobile. And, while Eid was at the 2 Mile Inn in County Clare, several calls came in from a number matching Sharon Collins. Early in the morning of February 26, 2007, Detective Sergeant Michael Maloney and Detective Garda Ernie White quietly pulled into the long driveway of Ballybeg House, the home Sharon Collins shared with PJ Howard. When Sharon opened the door, she pleasantly greeted the officers. They had a warrant to search the house and a warrant for Sharon's arrest on suspicion of conspiracy to murder. They were there for the home computer. PJ had been at the gym when Gardaí arrived and returned home to find the house being raided. Gardaí told him Sharon had been taken to Ennis Garda Station. During her interview, Sharon denied any knowledge of a plot to kill her partner and stepsons, Gardaí told Sharon they believed her home computer, which she was adamant was only used by her, was used to log into the Lying Eyes 98 email account. Sharon denied it. She said this must be related to her being blackmailed just before the office was broken into. Sharon told them a different story. She told Gardaí that, in mid-2006, she received an email from an American-Italian woman named Maria Marconi, asking if Sharon might like to become a writer. She didn't know why Maria had asked that, but she answered that yes, she might like to write a novel. Sharon said Maria became her writing mentor, and in June 2006, she visited Sharon in Ennis. She said they had met at the office, where Maria asked to check her emails, and Sharon let her use the work laptop. She told Gardaí that they kept in regular contact, and soon Sharon was sharing her personal troubles with Maria, including details about PJ's unusual sexual practices. One day, Maria emailed to tell her that her own laptop had been stolen. After this, Sharon said she was contacted by a blackmailer requesting money, and if it was not paid, PJ would be informed of the things she had written to Maria about him. She claimed this was the reason she sent €15,000 to Las Vegas. She told Gardaí she by then believed Maria had been behind it all along. Sharon gave a description of Maria, but she said she wasn't able to provide any contact details. While Sharon was being interviewed, the cybercrime unit accessed the hard drive of the computer taken from the house. It appeared someone had tried to wipe information from it, but without success. A user of that computer had been logging into two email accounts, SharonCollins at Aircom, as well as LyingEyes98 at Yahoo. After LyingEyes98 had the initial call with Tony, a follow-up email was written to him. It was pages and pages long. The author wrote, "I am extremely nervous about sending this message, and even talking on the phone. There are actually three men, but two of them would probably be together, and the third would not be in Ireland. He would be in Spain. The first two live in Ireland. The town they live in is Ennis. They are brothers. One aged 27, big guy, and 23, not so big. They share a house at present, but there are two others living in the house as well. I do not want it to look like a hit. This is important. I want it to look like an accident, perhaps travelling in a car or boat or poisoned, or maybe you have some ideas of your own. The third is an older man and not very fit or strong. He would probably be in Spain. Again, not to look like a hit, perhaps a suicide, or is it possible to look like natural causes? He's got a lot of health problems." The email went on and on. The author asked, how long, how much, and said, "I would have no problem getting hold of money, but tricky beforehand." Then the author asked questions about paying a deposit. Tony, or Ede, wrote back, "We have people all over the world, usually $50,000 per person, but three birds with one stone, I'll do all for $90,000. Over the next 2 weeks, the emails between LyingEyes98 and Tony got more personal. Tony asked, "We suppose these people are your stepsons and husband?" LyingEyes wrote, "His boys are going to suffer. I wish it didn't have to be like this, but I know that if my husband was dead and they were still here, they'd screw me. I've no conscience about my husband. He's a real asshole and makes my life hell. But I do feel bad about the others. I would prefer it if it was just my husband, but because of the way he has arranged his affairs, it would be way too complicated if his sons were still around. I've got children of my own and intend on being around for them. That's another reason why I want to be as careful as possible, so that I don't end up in jail." The emails contained claims that the husband tried to force her into lewd sex acts with him and others, including strangers. The sender provided Tony with maps and instructions, and pictures. Captioning one, they wrote, "You'll be able to tell which one is my husband, and I'm the devil in the red dress." Tony wrote back, "Don't get mad when I see you in Malaga. If I like you, I'll kiss you." Tony also shared photos of himself, and Gardaí could see clearly Tony was Assam Eid. "You're very handsome," Sharon replied. On August 11, 2006, Tony Luciano emailed Lying Eyes 98 again. He wrote, "You can send $15,000 by Wednesday, another $30,000 by August the 18th, and $45,000 no later than 7 hours after the job has been done. This is our contract, or you will be our target. Sorry to say that, but this is our policy." A few days later, Lying Eyes 98 wrote, "I've decided to parcel up the deposit money. I will probably send something else with it to make it look like a present. I'll also put in photos and the keys." As the time approached for Tony to fly to both Ireland and then to Spain to carry out the job, Sharon confirmed she would pay for Tony and his business associate to fly to both Ireland and Spain and would cover all expenses. She would pay using PJ's credit card. Lying Eyes 98 asked, "If the cops seized the computer, could they find evidence of my search?" She instructed Eid to include a cover-up of her activity as part of the job. She told him, "You'll have to take away the computers from the Downs and Howard office." She also provided the security alarm code. And so the plan was laid out. First, Tony would fly to Ireland and track down the sons at the Greyhound Bar in Kilkee, where they went most weekends to stay at the family holiday house. There, Tony would poison their drinks. Tony would then fly to Spain, where Sharon would be with PJ. The plan was to make it appear Tony had jumped from the 14th floor balcony of his penthouse, taking his own life as he was so overwhelmed with grief over the loss of his sons. Comparing the evidence sent over from the US with the digital evidence they had in Ireland, Gardaí were left in no doubt there were only two people deeply involved in the plan to murder the three Howard men. Eid and Tony were not separate people. They were separate identities of the same man. Detectives then began trawling through Sharon's emails, going further back in time. A few months before she contacted the Hire a Hitman website, there were two automated email responses sent from the Gerry Ryan show on RTE Radio, then one of the most popular radio shows in Ireland. These were in response to emails she had written to the show from her own personal email address. Sharon's email subject line read, "Sleeping with the enemy." She requested not to be identified. She told the show that her partner's black moods and tantrums were unbearable. She accused PJ of frequenting prostitutes and swingers clubs near Malaga on the Costa del Sol, and of wanting her to pick up a stranger and to engage in sex work herself. When Gardaí discovered the emails, they contacted the Gerry Ryan show. The show told Gardaí that they received around 2,000 emails a month, and both of Sharon's emails had been filtered out before reaching Gerry. And the computers kept on giving up their secrets. Detectives found that someone using the home computer had seamlessly switched between searching diet tips and kitchen designs to researching lethal poisons. One in particular was for ricin poisoning. The user of the computer had wanted to know how to buy and manufacture it. By this time, Gardaí's interrogation clock had run out and they were forced to release Sharon Collins without charge. Despite her being arrested for trying to have him and his sons killed, PJ Howard stood by Sharon. He couldn't believe she would do anything to hurt himself or his children. People who knew them spoke of their deep shock when details spread of the allegations that Sharon was involved. Essam Eid was in Limerick prison, awaiting trial for the extortion. But as the case grew, his case was delayed to gather more evidence. On March 1st, 2007, a week after Sharon's release, Gardaí confronted Eid with questions about his emails and calls, and his true relationship with Sharon. He denied it all. He denied running the Hire a Hitman website. He denied ever having an email address under the name Tony Luciano. He said his wife Teresa must have been responsible for the calls, and possibly even the emails. When shown photocopies of Sharon's phone number from his address book in Las Vegas, Eid said he had no idea whose number it was. He said he lied about his affair with Sharon Collins, being his lover, and was pressured by Teresa to say that while they sat together in the cell at Ennis Garda Station. He now said he didn't know Sharon at all. That day, Eid's charges shifted. He was now under suspicion of conspiracy to commit murder. Gardaí dropped the charges against his wife, Teresa Engel. In return, she agreed to cooperate with Gardaí and the FBI. She pleaded guilty to lesser charges of handling stolen property, and the Director of Public Prosecutions granted her immunity from prosecution. In exchange for total legal protection in Ireland, she agreed to return to Dublin as a prosecution witness. Teresa then flew back to the US and began cooperating with the FBI on their separate case against Essam Eid. Later that month, PJ wrote a letter to the Director of Public Prosecutions. He wrote that he believed completely in Sharon's innocence. He was in no doubt she was the victim of a scam run by Eid, his wife Teresa, and the woman Sharon had mentioned to Gardaí, but they had found no trace of, Maria Marconi. PJ was so sure of Sharon's innocence that he paid for her to travel to Las Vegas to track down Maria. He had funded hiring a private investigator to help the search. Sharon returned to Ennis without ever finding Maria. Sharon also wrote three letters to the DPP, pleading her innocence. She said she was writing with the support and encouragement of PJ. She wrote about how she had fallen in love with him at first sight. But Gardaí had discovered underlying problems in their relationship. They learned that, despite the appearance that Sharon was content with not marrying PJ, his decision not to marry had angered her. Gardaí made another discovery, one that cast further doubt on the image of a happy relationship, and gave an insight into Sharon's mindset. In November 2005, following the wedding blessing party with friends and family, Sharon logged on to proxymarriages.com and, for €1,000, purchased a fake Mexican marriage certificate in the name of Sharon Howard. A later email to the proxy marriage service, signed off as being from PJ, asked why the certificate was taking so long. Sharon had then panicked and contacted the Mexican embassy in Dublin to verify the validity of the fake proxy marriage certificate. She was told that there was no way the certificate she had purchased would be validated in Ireland. It was a hoax. She then wrote again to Proxy Marriages, angrily saying the couple were worried about their respective children, arguing over inheritance rights, should either she or PJ die. Finally armed with the fake marriage certificate, Sharon drove to Cork to the passport office. She used the certificate to get an updated passport under her new name, Sharon Howard. In her eyes, she was then officially PJ's wife. And if she was his wife and something happened to both PJ and his sons, she would be set to inherit everything. In Los Angeles, the FBI interviewed Eid's wife, Teresa Engel. She described the way Eid had dominated and controlled her and made her live with his other wife. She told them about €15,000 arriving at their house wrapped in paper and cardboard, and sent with a pair of gaming goggles. The team investigating the LA case were concerned about internet searches Eid and Sharon had both done on the almost undetectable poison ricin. A dose the size of a grain of salt could kill a person with a slow and painful death. Ede and Sharon had both searched how to make it. Knowing they'd found a dead castor bean plant in Ede and Teresa's garden, the FBI were worried Ede had produced his own. Sotelo pressed Teresa about the ricin. She told them that after researching how to make the poison, Ede had purchased the raw castor beans online. She told the agents about her and Ede making ricin in the garage. She said he brought it to Ireland in a contact lens case. It was in Ede's bag of toiletries. The FBI called the Gardaí and learned Ede's toiletry bag had been allowed into the prison with him when he went into custody. Gardaí had returned it to him after the hotel raid because it contained the medication he needed for his heart condition and diabetes. They didn't and couldn't realise that a deadly poison was potentially inside the bag. Forensic detectives rushed to execute an emergency tactical search of Ede's cell, wearing hazmat suits. In his cell, they found his toiletry bag. Inside, a small, empty, plastic contact lens container. Once it was secured, it was flown under military escort to a dedicated chemical defence facility in the UK. The contact lens case tested positive for traces of ricin. On June 26, 2007, 4 months after being released from her previous arrest, Sharon Collins was surprised to find Gardaí arrive at her quiet country home once again. This time, Gardaí had the evidence they needed. Back at Enniscarta station, Gardaí pushed Sharon to discuss her relationship with PJ and asked about her passport and the name change she had made to it. She said that she had wanted to change her name as a gesture to PJ, since they couldn't marry. She denied it had anything to do with proving she was entitled to any inheritance. Sharon Collins and Sam Ede were taken to the district court in Kilkee that day. Their story had come full circle and taken them to the town where the Howards' holiday home was and to where Robert and Niall's murders were supposed to take place at the Greyhound Bar. It was the first time the pair had ever come face to face. After a 9-month investigation, Superintendent John Scanlon told the court, "The charges before the court are conspiracy to murder, and I am implying that the two be remanded in custody." Sharon was granted bail on strict conditions, while Ede was denied. It would mean almost a year in custody, as he awaited what would be one of the most shocking and sensational trials in Irish history. In May 2008, the trial of Sharon Collins and Sam Ede began at the Central Criminal Court in Dublin. While awaiting trial for almost a year, Sharon Collins had lived at the home she shared with PJ Howard, the man she was accused of having attempted to have murdered. The case would come to be known as the Lying Eyes case, and by the time the trial had begun, it had stirred up media and public interest unlike many trials in the history of the Irish state. After a late start on day one, Mr. Justice Roderick Murphy invited the jury of 8 men and 4 women into the court. The indictment was read out, listing 6 charges against Sharon and 3 against Sam Ede. They were both charged with 3 counts of conspiracy to murder, essentially agreeing together to kill 3 men. Sharon was charged with soliciting to murder, for seeking Ede to murder them. And Ede was charged with demanding money with menaces or extortion and handling stolen property following the dropping of the burglary charge. They both denied all charges and pleaded not guilty. At one end of a long wooden bench sat Sharon Collins, chewing gum and constantly drinking water. Throughout the 7 weeks that followed, she often wrote yellow post-it notes and passed them to her legal team with her thoughts. At the other end of the bench, Sam Ede held his head in his hands and rubbed his eyes. He chatted to the exhibits officers, and very occasionally he would shift his eyes to look over at Sharon, who never once looked back at him. Ede appeared friendly in court. He smiled and waved to reporters and his team. He had no family in the public gallery to support him, but there was one man, an Egyptian man living in Dublin, who attended on occasions as a sign of support. Sharon's two sons attended every day. Senior counsel for the prosecution, Tom O'Connell, presented Sharon, who was neatly dressed in a black suit and crisp white shirt, as the younger blonde bombshell partner scorned when her rich man wouldn't marry her. Sharon was depicted as a blonde temptress devoted to astrology, weight loss websites, and a get-rich scheme that wildly backfired. Gardaí, close to the case, had referred to Sharon as making Catherine Nevin look like an angel, in reference to the woman who had hired a hitman to murder her husband, Tom Nevin, in Wicklow in 1996. The prosecution barristers warned the jury not to believe Sharon's claims of innocence. They said she had methodically deceived PJ Howard and plotted a dramatic way to not only inherit his millions, but also make sure both he and his sons were dead as a result. The prosecution said that Sharon attempting to present herself as a victim was her final cruel manipulation of her partner of 10 years. They believed she had invented the mysterious and never seen woman, Maria Marconi. Presenting their evidence against Ede, the prosecution let the digital trail speak for itself. They argued that the fact that Ede had risked bringing Ryson into Ireland showed he was prepared to carry out the murders at any cost. They told the court that the evidence found against Sam Ede and Sharon Collins had well and truly proven that their plan was not a work of fantasy or fiction, but had been put into very real action. The atmosphere in court number 2 was already highly charged before the prosecution called PJ Howard as a witness. As he took his position in the stand, the packed courtroom fell silent. When questioned, instead of portraying a terrified victim, he shocked the courtroom by fiercely defending Sharon and saying the allegations against her were astonishing and did not make sense. He said, "It's totally out of character. In the 10 years I've known Sharon, she has never asked for anything." He explained how well she had cared for him during his quadruple bypass in 2000 and told the court they had a great life together. When he stood down to return to a seat, he walked directly over to Sharon, sitting with her legal team, and planted a massive passionate kiss on her lips. There were audible gasps in the courtroom, but Sharon didn't appear surprised. The following day, PJ returned to sit in the public gallery to show the jury he was standing by Sharon. Over the years, PJ Howard had managed to keep a low profile around Ennis, staying out of the spotlight. He was well known, but a deeply private man. But that day, the court heard the words of the email sent to the Gerry Ryan radio show. PJ Howard's alleged private life was laid bare, both inside the courtroom and in the press. Whether true or not, they were allegations that would forever follow him. Gerry Ryan himself was called as a witness. His testimony lasted a matter of minutes, and some wondered why the radio star was called, merely to confirm he didn't receive an email. FBI agent Sotelo gave evidence about cases of murder for hire, saying, "A lot of people might say they want someone dead," she explained, "but unless you do something to put it in action, you haven't committed a crime." When another FBI agent, Special Agent Scott Bakken, had his turn in the witness box, he was asked about Maria Marconi, the woman Sharon claimed had been her writing mentor and had set her up. He explained that this person, Maria Marconi, did not have a social security number or a driver's license, nor had she ever had any dealings with law enforcement. She had never owned any property or been listed as having any utilities registered under her name. Immigration held no record of a woman of that name exiting or re-entering the United States during the time she allegedly visited Sharon Collins. There was no trace of the mysterious Maria Marconi. Furthermore, no emails were ever located between any of Sharon Collins' email accounts and the apparent literary mentor. It seemed there was no evidence to suggest Maria Marconi ever existed. Sam Ede's arguments were presented to the court as he was not being called as a witness due to his poor health after having spent almost 2 years in prison awaiting trial, struggling with diabetes and having a pacemaker in his heart. Ede's legal team described him as simply a con man and not a hitman, and said he had taken the fall for his wife Teresa, who by then had moved out of their house and relocated to another state. He had claimed to be an innocent victim who ended up on the longest holiday of his life, and suggested his wife had been far better placed than him to enter into an email correspondence with Lying Eyes 98. He claimed he was not the only person with access to his home computers. He said he saw Teresa open emails from Lying Eyes 98, emails containing pictures of PJ Howard and his two sons, and he argued the tone in the emails from Tony Luciano sounded nothing like him. However, he had no explanation for how the contact lens case that contained traces of ricin was in his toiletry bag. He'd never worn contact lenses in his life and was scared to have anything in his eyes, he said. But Gardy told the court that when they entered his cell that day to conduct a search, Ede claimed that he'd lost his contact lenses 2 months after arriving in prison. By the time Sharon Collins entered the witness box, defended by Eugene O'Kelly, it was day 24 of the trial. She had begun the trial bright and engaged, bubbly almost. But by the time she took the stand, she was tearful and quiet. She spent the first portion of her testimony answering questions from her own defense barrister, allowing her to present her version of events. But when questions from the prosecution landed sharply, she hit back. When asked about her and PJ's relationship, she said, like everyone, they had their ups and downs, but she never hated him. She said, anybody who knows me knows that I don't, and I don't do good acting. I'm bad at it. When it was suggested that she was just after PJ's money, she said no, saying, money doesn't float my boat at all. She described buying her fake marriage certificate as simply a private act of defiance. The prosecution questioned why PJ hadn't been seen in the courtroom for over 2 weeks, suggesting he wasn't as sure about her as she believed. She had an answer for this too. She asked the court, had he a choice after the humiliation he's been put through? During the final 2 hours of her 2 days of testimony, the prosecution's senior counsel, Unor Neo Rafferty, played into Sharon's game, knowing she hit back. She insisted Sharon and Lying Eyes 98 were the same person. Sharon denied it. Neo Rafferty mentioned the origins of the term Lying Eyes, suggesting that she and Sharon Collins were of a similar age. Lying Eyes was a song by the Eagles, she said. Surely Sharon remembered it. Sharon had an answer for that too. A friend of mine pointed it out to me recently. She sent me the first verse of it, but Justin Timberlake is more my thing. Neo Rafferty replied, did you know the song was about a beautiful young woman moving in with a rich old man and cheating on him? While the prosecution attempted to pull apart Sharon's defense inside the courtroom, her two young adult sons remained an unwavering fixture in the public gallery, attending every day of the trial. Beyond the couple of days PJ attended, her sons remained her only supporters in the court. As she stepped away from the witness box after 2 days of testimony, she wept openly. 2 days later, when Unor Neo Rafferty concluded her 100-minute-long closing speech, she read out the last 2 lines of that Eagles song, Lying Eyes. You can't hide those lying eyes, and your smile is a thin disguise. She then quoted Shakespeare, a man may smile and smile and be a villain. When the jury returned their verdict, Sharon Collins was found guilty of all 6 charges. 3 counts of both conspiracy and 3 counts of soliciting to murder. 3 of the female jurors burst into tears as the verdicts were read out. Although it had been unanimous, the case had taken a significant toll on the jurors. Each of the 6 convictions carried a 10-year term, but in the Irish legal system, sentences for crimes arising from the exact same event are typically served concurrently, meaning that they run at the same time, rather than consecutively. This meant Sharon Collins was facing a maximum of 10 years. The jury found Ede guilty of extortion and handling stolen goods, but not guilty of conspiracy to murder. The jury felt there wasn't enough evidence to prove his guilt beyond reasonable doubt. He was facing 14 years for his convictions. At sentencing the following month, the judge was handed letters of support for Sharon Collins and appeals for a lenient sentence. The Bishop of Killaloe, the Mayor of Ennistown, and her ex-husband, who described her as a supportive and loving mother. PJ and his sons were invited to give victim impact statements. The packed courtroom was stunned when PJ Howard took the stand to speak again. He told Mr. Justice Roderick Murphy, "Sharon is, in my opinion, one of the nicest people you could ever have been fortunate to know. She is a caring, lovely, and decent lady. I will not give up on Sharon, and I would have no hesitation whatsoever in living with her again." He pleaded for leniency. "I am asking the court not to impose a custodial sentence, as I do not believe that Sharon poses any threat to my sons. I ask the court to consider how a prison sentence would affect her mother, her two sons, and myself," he said. In complete contrast, when Tom O'Connell, SC for the prosecution, read out a statement on behalf of PJ's sons, Robert and Niall Howard, who had been Sharon's intended targets, along with their father, the court heard their anger. "We can't understand why we were propelled from our normal daily lives into such a national drama, and shudder at the realization that had the plan been effected, we could have been poisoned to death. It will take a long time, if at all, before we can put the incident behind us." In the end, Judge Roderick Murphy sentenced both Assam Ede and Sharon Collins to the same sentence, 6 years in prison. Sharon Collins' solicitor, Eugene O'Kelly, spoke outside the court. He said he'd been instructed to appeal against the conviction. "Miss Collins has been convicted by the jury and sentenced, but most importantly, she has been acquitted by her partner, Mr. Howard," he said. "She takes great comfort from the support that Mr. Howard has shown, and she has asked that I apologise on her behalf for the great hurt, embarrassment and distress that has been caused to him by the use of the state of an incomplete letter which was taken out of context." In a March 2010 appeal, it was argued that Sharon's conviction on conspiracy to murder was logically unsustainable and had to be thrown out. In Irish criminal law, a conspiracy requires an agreement between two or more people. You cannot legally conspire with yourself. And so, her lawyers argued, because Assam Ede was found not guilty of conspiring with Sharon to murder, then that would mean she had acted alone, and so her conviction was unsustainable. The Court of Criminal Appeal officially wiped those three convictions from her record, but it didn't reduce her prison sentence. After another 2.5 years in prison, Assam Ede was extradited back to the USA to face almost identical charges in federal court in California. In that case, a 28-year-old woman agreed to pay $37,000 to have her ex-boyfriend's new girlfriend murdered. She pleaded guilty to hiring Assam Ede to carry out the murder and using stolen credit cards to pay for his services. Ede received a 33-month prison sentence. In September 2012, with remission for good behaviour, Sharon Collins was released from prison after serving 3.5 years of her sentence. She had previously been granted weekend release and was allowed to return to her mother's home in Ennis. After her release, Collins began a new life in Belfast, working as a masseuse and a professional dog walker. She told the press that she would write a book and clear her name. She said she was speaking to several Hollywood producers in an attempt to see her story on screen. But to date, no Hollywood movie has been made. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. If you're enjoying the podcast, leaving a rating or review really helps. We've now passed 5,000 five-star ratings on Spotify, along with a growing number of reviews on Apple Podcasts. Those reviews make a real difference and help new listeners find the series. Make sure you like and subscribe to the podcast to get notified whenever a new episode is released. If you're listening on Spotify, you can also leave a comment on this episode. We read every comment and we're genuinely grateful for the time you take to share your thoughts. You can get in touch with us directly by emailing linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com if you have a question or a case you'd like us to cover. We'd love to hear from you. Follow us on Instagram at Lines of Inquiry Podcast, and if you can, share the podcast with others. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Producer is Siobhan Walsh. This episode was written by Anna Priestland and edited by Owen Brennan. Sound design and editing by Neil Kavanagh, with legal, marketing and social media support from the team at Go Loud. Sources for this episode include Lying Eyes and the Hitman for Hire by Emer Connolly, The Irish Independent, Irish Times, Clare People, Houston Chronicle, Las Vegas Sun, RTE, The Journal and The Guardian, and more. Join me next time as we open another case and follow the evidence wherever it leads. Because, in the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.